From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 46 for Friday, the 7th of October, 2011.
Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
Hi, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me this week, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And of course, our associate editor at editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
It's been a bit of a somber week.
It has.
Obviously, I don't think we're breaking any news when we say that we're very sad to hear about Steve Jobs passing away at 56 years old.
Very sad. He's a very big figurehead in technology, business, culture.
He's probably tech's biggest figurehead. You know, people in the street know who Steve Jobs is. It's not like kind of people on the street know who Meg Whitman is, for example, but they do know who Steve Jobs was.
Yeah. And not just a kind of celebrity. He actually kind of provoked this almost religious fervour from Apple fans, didn't
he? The cult of Mac.
Yeah,
the famous reality distortion field.
Yeah. I mean, the news broke in the UK around 1 a.m. on what is Thursday morning today, which is when we're actually recording this. And I was sort of going to bed and thought I was going to have a relatively early night at 1 a.m. even, which is actually quite early for me. And saw on Twitter the news broke, and then I think I went to bed about 4 after writing a story and following the tweets. It's a very, very, very sad day. The Regent Street Apple store has been full of people outside all day, and so is the one actually in Covent Garden. Someone had left kind of half-bitten apple outside the front door.
A bit of a manky homage to him. But
it'll be a bit manky by the end of the day, but it looked rather nice in a photograph I saw this morning.
Yeah.
And the timing's quite sad too as well. It's coming so soon after the iPhone 4S announcement.
That's it. I mean, it is kind of sad to think that, you know, will he have seen that announcement? Will he have seen that being launched? Or, you know, was he too ill to see that? I mean, we've never wanted on the podcast to talk about Steve Jobs' health because it's a very touchy subject. But obviously it's impossible not to mention it now. But I mean, we've known he's been ill for quite some time. And he announced actually a few years ago that he had pancreatic cancer, and he was very open about it, but also very open about his recovery from that. But we're not entirely sure at this point, at least, whether it was that had come back. I think that's something that we'll find out at a later date.
I mean, I think the prognosis for pancreatic cancer generally is very bad.
Very sad day, I think, for everybody. But without spending too long dwelling on the negative points from Apple this week, we did just a minute ago mention, of course, the iPhone 4S, which was announced. And kind of a weird product announcement, because everyone kind of was hoping for, you know, a hugely high-spec iPhone 5. And what they got was quite a high-spec iPhone 4. And it was quite weird. I got asked for a comment on Al Jazeera English earlier today, and they were sort of asking whether it was a huge disappointment. I said, well, if you redesigned the iPhone 4 and put the exact same specs into a slightly redesigned body, people probably wouldn't have been anywhere close to as disappointed as I think some people were. I mean, we're talking sort of dual core CPU, massively faster graphics, 8 megapixel camera, 1080p video. And
I mean, people have always been more excited about Apple's design than about their tech specs.
They have, but I think people lose track of the fact that the design is already pretty damn amazing.
But I think it's a good acknowledgement that they aren't making too many changes from an already excellent phone, as you say. I mean, if they'd called it the iPhone 5 and it had so few changes, it would be, you know, everyone would be outraged.
Definitely. I mean, there was a rumor that we were going to see two phones this week, and really what we've got is they've kept the iPhone 3GS as kind of what is essentially, I suppose, a budget iPhone. The iPhone 4 is going to drop to, I would guess, around £79-ish, but we don't know at the time we're recording this. And then the iPhone 4S will be the flagship. But there are some amazing specs in here. And the bit that I'm most excited about is actually the camera side of things. I mean, an Apple keynote wouldn't be an Apple keynote these days without highlighting how many people use the iPhone as a replacement to a compact camera. So the fact that they're moving to 8 megapixels, much better optics, so we hear, will test that ourselves next week, and much better video recording. I mean, it's a pretty amazing spec boost, even if the body hasn't changed.
The most exciting thing for me, other than, of course, the 12 new clock faces for the Nano, is it?
Yes, for the Nano.
For the Nano. Other than that, the most exciting thing was Siri, the voice-controlled virtual assistant.
Yeah, now I saw this demoed in person. I was at the Apple's keynote, and yes, it was scripted, and obviously it was the most carefully planned live execution, but it was still a live execution, and it did work at least how they demoed it. And I have heard from some other people who have been able to play with it in a back room that it, you know, on some things it does struggle with, but when it does do what they demoed it to do, and, you know, things like calendars and email and text messaging and stuff, it works like a charm. I'm very excited to play with this next week when it comes out, which will be the 14th of October for anyone wondering when the hell they can buy this stuff. 14th of October. iOS 5 is coming on the 12th of October. And I think we've probably talked enough about Apple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we talk about dust?
Duncan, tell me about this dust that you've been writing about. Scientists have gone all happy about dust. What the H?
Well, I didn't get the pleasure of writing about this. It was one of our daily news contributors, Mark. But he wrote a story about chemists from Ohio State University who accidentally have built a library of dust particles.
Why?
Well, they were developing a new infrared sensor, which has a kind of metal mesh inside it. And they were having problems with it. They were finding that dust was getting stuck inside this mesh. But as part of their testing, they found that they were able to tell different particles of dust from each other. And from that, they managed to catalogue 63 unique dust particles from within their laboratory. And they want to look at more.
But why? I mean, what is the use of having a catalogue of 60-odd dust particles, really? I mean, I find it very difficult to, you know, to pull up, you know, Excitement Cat and to make him smile on this.
Well, like, other than the kind of compulsion to catalogue everything in the world around us, which is, you know, there's a factor of that. A library of dust types can also help the study of kind of respiratory diseases, asthma, various, you know, allergies, that kind of thing. Mm. Dust can be quite problematic in those circumstances, and also in manufacturing. But these chemists, led by a chap called James Coe, do care, and they catalogued these ones in their lab. They found that 40 of the 63 unique particles were organic in origin, from plant or animal material. You might find that a bit icky.
Skin,
that sort of thing. But also, the second most prolific ingredient was quartz, which was found in 34 of the samples.
I'm struggling to think of anything more interesting to ask. It's rare that we have exciting dust news. It's more of an oxymoron, isn't it? Exciting dust news.
Well, should we move on then?
Let's move on. Liv, you wrote about a dude who's cutting up vinyl records and stitching them together like some kind of crazed hipster.
Yes, he is. There's a designer called Isaac Bertrand. I don't know if I pronounced his name correctly. He's from Barcelona. And what he's been doing is actually cutting up, finding old records in secondhand stores and cutting out little sections using a laser cutter and replacing them with sections from other records to kind of create a new hybrid made out of up to like four different records.
So essentially what he's doing here is he's using old audio and video editing techniques and creating an art out of it.
It's a kind of an artistic kind of experiment or a thought piece. He is really into his music, but the final result isn't perfect. There's always a tiny little gap in, you know, where it's kind of slotted in, so it isn't something you'd be able to, you know, crank out at a discotheque.
It must be quite difficult to find the kind of bits that match up with each other, because you'd need to have, I guess, records that are exactly the same BPM,
and then
chunks, samples that fit into exactly the same point in the record. Otherwise, the curvature wouldn't work.
Exactly, and I think that's where the
that's where he's been having difficulty.
He's having a few problems.
So, what's the end result with this? Is he just going to put this on display, or is he actually going to DJ with it or something?
What's cool is he's just documented the process. I mean, he started off using like hot wires to cut it, then knives, and then laser cutters. And he's just documented it as a kind of thought piece, I guess, or an experiment. I don't think he's going to be DJing this, but you can check it out on our website if you look up vinyl sliced, maybe. You can see a video and you can hear the end result.
Well, the end result of this section is going to be that we're going to have a little quick break. And when we come back, we have, well, I'm going to read this headline out. It contains the word tsunami pod. That wasn't a headline, actually, was it?
No.
No.
The Wired 2011 Summit is now just a few days away. Don't miss your chance to hear inspiring talks by speakers from Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft Research, IDEO, McLaren, Refugees Reunited, London Serpentine Gallery, and dozens more. For tickets and more information, visit wiredevent.co.uk.
Ah, good, you're still with us. Excellent. Liv, there's a business in Japan that's creating some kind of pod.
It is a pod. Yeah. Yes.
As if that wasn't... How many more times can we use the word pod in
we
this section
use
of the
it
podcast?
A few more times. It's nothing to do with the podcast. It is a company
Ooh,
called.
I bet it is.
Oh,
podcast
we could cast
as a verb.
Pod. Okay. All right. Ah. We're getting somewhere.
Sort of.
Yes. A company called New Cosmopower, which is quite a cool name, has built these tiny little personal pods that you can sit in when the next tsunami comes. Obviously, slightly capitalizing on the horrific tsunami and earthquake in Japan in March of this year.
So what? It's a pod that a whole bunch of people can go and sit in and survive if the tsunami comes. What, like a floating ball on water?
It's like a spherical chamber made out of kind of fiberglass, and it's bright yellow. It looks like a Lego man's head, and you can sit anywhere between 4 and 12 people inside it, depending on which one you buy.
And does it have kind of like storage areas for food and clean water and things like that?
It seems to be just a big chamber, which is a bit strange, with a kind of mini pole down, a pole down the centre to kind of keep the structure together.
Or dance.
Or dance, yes. So yeah, it could potentially be a bit of a mess in there and quite stressful because it's completely sealed, so it's dark.
And what happens, let's say a tsunami rises,
right.
You run into your pod, you shut the door, what are the next three things that are going to happen?
Okay,
you sit in darkness.
You sit and you wait in darkness as you're buffeted around by the waves, but presumably you won't be, you know, a lot of the kind of fatalities from tsunamis is from being bashed into things, and this pod protects you from that.
Ah, so it's built to last, it's built to be bounced around
it's
like a
built to be bounced
bead
around.
Of sweat in a large person.
And does it kind of stay upright, so if it kind of flips over on its top?
Yeah. It's kind of, it's got, what are those old weebles are they called? You know, where you push them over and they kind of come back to
center. They wobble, but they don't fall down.
I think they've got some kind of mechanism within them that makes sure that they always right themselves. Although I imagine in a tsunami, it's pretty churny, if that's a word.
So are you going to get one?
I'm not sure. I'm not kind of that stressed out about tsunamis in London Bridge. But
no.
Who knows?
Not for the time being, anyway.
Not for the time being.
Well, staying on the topic of weather, I think that this chap may be massively excited by our next topic.
Oh my God, it's full on! Double rainbow all the way across the sky! Oh my God!
I love this guy. No?
He's definitely going to have pointy pants when he hears this news, isn't he?
He is. Thanks for that, Liv.
That's okay.
It's a great mental
image. Come on, Duncan.
Sorry.
What's the news?
Okay. Yeah, he's going to be very happy indeed because meteorologists have managed to confirm the rumoured existence of triple and quadruple rainbows.
Wow.
Wow.
So we've had exciting dust news and now quadruple rainbows. This
quadruple
is like the
rainbows.
World's most exciting podcast.
Is the source of the rainbows a unicorn?
No, I'm afraid not. Rainbows actually occur when sun shines through water droplets that are raining down from the sky, hence rainbow. When the... you must have kind of seen light passing through... Say like if you've got a spoon in a glass of water, the spoon looks like it bends because the light is bending. And when... sunlight passes into a raindrop, it will bend as well. But the different parts of the light, the different colours, bend different amounts. They refract, producing that kind of rainbow effect. And then what happens is the curvature of that raindrop kind of concentrates that light onto a specific part of the sky.
Okay, and so what happens with double rainbows and triple rainbows then?
Okay, well, what happens is that most of the light kind of exits the raindrop, but a little bit is reflected back into the raindrop again by the surface. And that goes round the whole cycle again, refracts again, and then shines out. And so that's when you get a double rainbow. And so for a triple one, it has to go around yet again. And every time you're losing the vast majority of the light, so it gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And that's why people haven't like necessarily seen triple rainbows on a more regular basis.
It's starting to even look like a triple rainbow.
And so the news here being a quadruple rainbow has been what, observed?
Has been observed, yeah, exactly. Well, captured on film. A chap called Raymond Lee from the US Naval Academy studied 5 legitimate scientific reports of triple rainbows that have been seen in the last 250 years. These things aren't very common. And used a computer model to try and work out what the best conditions are to make them observable. And he found out that what you really need, you kind of need a situation where you've got dark thunderclouds and heavy rain, and then the sun shining through a gap in those clouds, and then you can see the triple rainbow on the dark thundercloud backdrop.
And so in terms of what this means for rainbowage and general rainbow fandom, what can we learn from this? What does this mean for the world's rainbow fans?
What does this mean?
Well, it means that when it is raining very, very heavily and there's a really, really strong double rainbow in front of you, the best thing to do isn't to look at it and go, ooh. It's to turn around and look at the sun, because that's where the triple and the quadruple rainbows appear. They appear on the opposite side to the single and double rainbows. If you turn around, look over there, you've got a good chance of actually seeing a triple rainbow.
Wow. Some fantastic advice there from a man with a meteorology degree. So I kind of tend to think that whatever he says is worth listening to.
Indeed.
Let's move on very briefly to a little bit more tech, actually, because late one night earlier this week, Microsoft and a whole bunch of people announced that the Xbox 360 is getting a huge number of new TV streaming services and movie streaming services. In the UK, we're going to get stuff from the BBC, from Channel 4, like 4OD, Channel 5, Love Film, YouTube, and Blinkbox and people like that. Lots and lots of new stuff, which in a way is playing catch-up to what the PS3 has had for a while, but this is still kind of amazing because Xbox already has things like Sky, like you can stream live Sky so you don't need a satellite dish, and this kind of adds a new on-demand element to it, which I think in a way for some people could completely replace satellite or cable TV. I mean, I don't watch that much telly, but what I do watch is on demand. Yeah. I could theoretically now get rid of my Virgin box if I wanted to and just have an Xbox.
But they're holding all this to a ransom, aren't they?
They are. So the problem is on Xbox is that for what we know at the moment, the vast majority of these new services, you're going to need an Xbox Live Gold account, which is about £40 a year. So it's going to come at a premium. And for some of these services, you're already paying a subscription. So Love Film, for example, you need a package, I think, that costs $5.99 a month or more. But if you pay that and you already have an Xbox Live Gold subscription, then you're going to get Love Film as part of your account. You're going to get Channel 4 as part of your Xbox Live account because it's ad-supported. So there's no extra cost there.
But the BBC is a partner. And surely, don't they have a part in their a stipulation in the license fee, which basically says that they can't charge again for it?
Yeah, and you know, this isn't the first time this problem has come up. We've argued, well, not on the podcast, but I've personally argued with the BBC to try and find out why the BBC iPlayer hasn't been on the Xbox when it has a commitment to being available on all popular media sort of consumption devices, which is one of the reasons they're on iPad and they're on phones and they're on the Wii even. And basically what we believe is that it's a problem with the license fee. You're already paying for the BBC as part of the fee, and the BBC isn't able to sort of give that service through a medium that requires you pay another fee.
And Microsoft isn't prepared to just let people have it for free.
Well, that's the thing. We don't know. I mean, at the moment, I tried to find out from Microsoft and from the BBC earlier this week. I got in touch with them to find out if this is going to be part of an Xbox Gold subscription. They couldn't confirm it, but we do know that some of the services announced this week are going to be part of one of the tiers of Xbox Live that you don't have to pay for. If that's BBC iPlayer or not, we don't know. It could just be that this is BBC Worldwide stuff, which they technically would be able to charge for, but time will tell. This will all launch, by the way, towards the end of the year, in time for Christmas at least, so a little time to wait, but you know, I use so many of these services that are being brought to the Xbox, so this is pretty cool. I'm excited. Can you see how excited I am, Liv?
Really excited.
Mm. For the listeners, he's looking extremely excited.
I am. This is the face of a man who's excited.
And
some the
pointy pants going on here.
Coming steady. Let's just have one last quick story before we move on, because we have some audio to go with it. Blue Brain. Duncan.
Yeah, long-term listeners to the podcast might remember a band called Blue Brain, who put together an album earlier this year called The National Mal, which is location-based. You don't listen to it chronologically over time. You listen to it geographically. It changes depending on where you are.
And I think in episode 27, earlier this year, we had an audio clip and we played something that they did from the National Mall, and now people are listening to this new thing.
Yes.
Which is what you can hear in the background, by the way. Duncan, what is this?
This is
what are we hearing?
This is an album called Listen to the Light, which instead of using the National Mall in Washington, D.C. as its inspiration, it takes New York's Central Park instead. In most other ways, it's exactly the same. It's just it's different music in a different place.
And as you walk from one place to another place, the device that you're listening on, which is, I think is an iPhone.
iPhone or iPad.
It knows where you are, and so it can change the music based on your location. So when you hear the music change, it's because you're physically moving location to a different object in the environment that this album is based around.
Yeah, this piece that you're listening to right now is placed on the east side of Central Park, around the south of the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
I know that the last time we spoke to these guys, and in fact, there's a lot of background on this, in episode 27, we got an interview with the two guys behind the Blue Brain project, I guess. And they did mention at one point, I think, coming to London. Is that right?
Yeah, well, maybe. I hope so. I mean, they're working on a bunch of different places. The reason they picked Central Park is because they wanted to choose something that an awful lot of, you know, a location that a lot of people would go to. They spoke before about maybe doing Highway 1 in California. I'd really like to see it kind of rolled out more and, you know, around the world. You know, I love the idea of a kind of atlas of albums that you could listen to when you go to different places by different people.
If people want to hear more about the music, where can they go? We got it on the site.
Yeah, we've got it on the site. We've got a trailer for it. It's, if you search for Listen to the Light or Blue Brain, then you should find it.
On wired.co.uk, of
course. On wired.co.uk. And it's also in the App Store if you want to just download it and listen to it instead.
Cool. Well, that's going to do it for the news for this week. And we're going to move on to our feature, which is an interview that Katie has done with the world's first inventor in residence at the London Science Museum.
Mark Champkins braved the Dragon's Den to bring levitating cutlery, self-heating crockery and pre-chewed pencils to the public. Now he's been appointed as the Science Museum's first ever inventor-in-residence. We caught up with him to discuss Peter Jones, Shrunken Heads and Moon Boots. So thanks for joining us, Mark.
Hello. Hello.
First thing that we want to talk about is your new appointment as the very first inventor-in-residence at the Science Museum. So how did it come about and what does the role involve?
Well, the role involves designing products that have been inspired by the archives and the collection that they have at the museum. So I get a chance to rummage through what the public doesn't see. I get a chance to wander around the museum and come up with product ideas, which is a really fertile place to be. And it came about because I approached them. I've written a book about inventions and discovered the kind of things that prominent public figures that you wouldn't really expect to have come up with things have invented. So Margaret Thatcher invented soft scoop ice cream, for example, and I found that fascinating. I ended up writing a book about it, and I approached a museum to see whether they'd be interested in doing an exhibition or using some of the content, and they suggested that I could perhaps have this role of inventing things for them. So that's how it came about, and that's what the job's about.
So what have you invented for the Science Museum?
There are two ways I've been doing it. The first is to look at things I'm inspired by in terms of the aesthetics and how they work. So one example is a gramophone. On my way into work, I walk past a beautiful gramophone every morning, and it occurred to me that it was amplifying the sound of a needle on a record, which is quite quiet, amplifying it up just using the acoustics of the horn. And then it made me think of my iPhone and the fact that quite often I just like it amplified a little bit louder so I can listen to it in a room or something. And I thought, well, why not make, you know, an iPod trumpet, if you like. And so I used the gramophone in the museum to recreate the sculpting and the shape of it, and this lovely kind of £5-10 price point product for kids in their bedrooms. And that was one thing. And another one is using principles of science that are kind of quite interesting or quirky, using magnets, which I find fascinating. I've managed to make levitating cutlery. So I've got a placemat and I positioned the magnets in the base and then magnets in the actual cutlery and managed to get them to float. So it's things like that pique the imagination and curiosity, but also are unique to the museum.
Are there any inventions you've come across in the Science Museum of which you're not really surprised they never saw the light of day?
The funny thing is, the archives themselves are the things that aren't in the museum, obviously. And there are lots of kind of failed inventions and blind alleys and things. But the most disturbing stuff they've got is actually their medical collection. And actually, some of the things that were just daft technologies and things that never worked. I mean, they've got, for example, they've got a case full of heads that they've cast of criminals, and there was a whole range of science called phrenology where they thought they were able to tell the character of a person by the shape of their heads because it supposedly corresponded to the shape of their brain, and their brain obviously has different areas controlling different behaviors. So that was the logic, and there was a whole field of science and products and all these odd gadgets and casts of heads with all the different parts of the, you know, goodness, badness, all kind of written on this skull for you to have your sort of DIY phrenology kit if you want to get into it. Absolutely daft stuff that was just a blind alley of science. So there's things like that which are out of the public eye and just odd, just really odd.
What's the coolest and less terrifying invention that you've seen in the archives?
Coolest thing. They've got a space suit. They've got one of the original spacesuits from Apollo 8, which was the one that they sent slightly before the moon landing just to make sure it got outside Earth's orbit. And it's just in a rack And I kind of can't believe that it's not in the museum. It's kind of dirty. And then they've actually got boots that have walked on the moon and they're dusty. Now, I was blown away by that. Now, I'm sure it's just, you know, some curator, you know, messing about with the boots on. It's just dust from the museum, probably. But it could be moon dust. And the fact that I can have a look at this and there's this dusty boot that's walked on the moon, it just blows me away. I just find that incredible.
How long have you been inventing?
Since I could, really, since I was young. And it doesn't feel like work to me. I recall at school, whenever you're in woodwork lessons or design lessons, I kind of thought, what, we're allowed to do this in school. You can just make and create things. And it was just nice tinkering. So I've been doing it since I was young and making go-karts and tree houses and that kind of stuff. I then went to engineering and then to the Royal College of Art. And all the time, it just feels like playing. So yeah, just do it whenever I can, really.
But the playing's actually taken you onto TV, hasn't it?
Well, I'd been working for a couple of years. So I had a product idea or a series of product ideas about helping kids to concentrate when they're at school and get the most out of their lessons. And the idea was, can you encourage kids to drink more water and eat more healthy foods and sit comfortably and do all the things that help them to sort of behave and be attentive? So it's easier for the teacher to teach, it's easier for them to learn. So I designed a series of products, and for about 3 years I'd been approached by the BBC. Each year they came back and said, you know, would you be interested in going on Dragon's Den? Because, you know, it was quite an interesting business. And I said no, because I just thought I can't control this and it could go badly wrong. And then I got to the point where one of the products, the lunchbox that I designed to protect fruit from being bashed, had gone into the John Lewis, and it was in one store, and I was trying to get it into all the stores. And then I thought, you know what, this could be a really good opportunity to do some publicity. As long as I don't do anything stupid or wet myself or do anything really embarrassing, then, you know, whether or not I get the money, it would be a great thing to do. And that's what I ended up doing.
What piece of technology or what invention do you believe would have the most impact on the public? And it doesn't have to be something that could be created anytime soon. It's something that, you know, could be created in 30, 40, 50 years' time.
These are being sprung on me, by the way. I've got no prior knowledge of this. I think actually it's going to be 3D printing. And it's a cliche to say it, but the more you think about how ridiculous it is that a part on a washing machine is made in China, you know, injection molded because it's cheapest, the people are paid less there, and then it's shipped, and all the costs involved with shipping something halfway across the world, and it might not be needed, it might be a spare part, so it sits in a warehouse for God knows how long until you break the handle off your washing machine or whatever it is, and then you get the replacement. And it just doesn't make any sense. And wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to create things locally and be able to print and have things maybe in your house or maybe in your local community, and you can just download a 3D part and have that ready? And also, I think it will open up people to be able to make things themselves, and they'll want to understand how things work and the difference in materials and the difference in mechanics and how, you know, how stuff really functions. And I think it will open up all kinds of opportunities for Britain to be, you know, leading the way in manufacturing, which it's kind of lost its way in, and open up all kinds of creative avenues.
So could it make inventors of us all?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I really do. And I think there's a whole movement toward craft, and I think people are rediscovering the delight of making something or being in a woodwork shop, or, you know, the smell and the textures of materials. And I think that this will also facilitate that kind of thing. You know, if you're a bit more techie and you interface better with computers, well, you can still use that as a way of creating 3D forms and then eventually having them, you know, in physical forms.
And last up, if people want to see more information, some images about your own products, where can they go?
My website is the Concentrate website, is where I sell my products. So that's concentrate.org.uk. And then there's kind of wiki pages, and the Science Museum has some stuff on the Science Museum products I've been doing.
And the book?
So yeah, the book is out next week and contains all kinds of extracts. I mean, fascinating stuff. Jamie Lee Curtis invented a nappy. There's a whole story behind that. Marlon Brando was into playing bongo drums and developed this bongo drum tuner. Charlie Sheen, bad boy Charlie Sheen, is actually so concerned about his looks that when he goes skiing, he's always putting chapstick on, always making sure that his lips are okay. And so he invented a chapstick dispenser so that he wouldn't have to keep taking his gloves on and off whilst he was skiing. He could keep his hands warm and he could keep putting chapstick on. So he spent time and energy and money to develop this patent and has a product out there. And there's 40 other examples of bizarre inventions that famous people have come up with. And that's out. It's called The Big Book of Celebrity Inventions. It's out next week.
Fantastic, Mark. Well, I'll definitely be leafing through that. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Mark Champkins, the Science Museum's first ever inventor in residence. I'm Katie Scott for the Wired.co.uk podcast.
She sure is for Wired.co.uk. Thank you, Katie. That's going to do our show for this week. You know what? We've actually got some feedback. We always ask for feedback, and we do get some. But this one I particularly want to read out on the show. This came in from Douglas Cameron, who said, just listening to podcast episode 45, and it reminded me that I first found Alpha Bite-like potato shapes in Tesco a few months ago and couldn't resist buying them for a bit of nostalgia dinner one evening. The great thing about them is that as an adult, there are so many more words you can make. Attached are a couple of examples we came up with after a little bit of inspiration from those rude hedgehogs of rathergood.com. And he sent us a photo of some words of questionable taste written out in these alphabets. And the reason he emailed this, we don't normally talk about food in the podcast, is because I really miss Bird's Eye potato alphabets, and I want to campaign for Bird's Eye to bring them back. I even got in touch with them and said, why have you taken these away? They're the most innovative foods in the world. You can write words. It's entertaining. It's great.
What did they say?
They said they discontinued them, but then Douglas wrote in and said they sell a kind of knockoff type thing in Tesco, and he sent me a link to where I can buy them. So thank you, Douglas.
If there's any other food you miss, then you should email us.
Yes, Liv, tell people how they can get in touch if they have other similar stories.
They can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
It doesn't have to be about food. It can be whatever you want.
Alternatively, you can get in and follow us or contact us on Twitter. We're on @wiredUK. And there's also a Facebook page. So if you just go to facebook.com/wiredUK and click that like button.
And I think on that note, we will see you again next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Stay hungry, stay foolish. Thank you all very much.